That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey guys, it's Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend and co-host of the Royal Blend podcast, here to introduce a special episode of the show where we have director Ed Zwick joining us as a guest. I really want to do more of these because it's when a filmmaker comes around and has a new book, a biography, where they're essentially going over their career, and it gives us an opportunity to sit down with a filmmaker and discuss some of their biggest hits. And with someone like Zwick, he has worked with some of the best in the business, including a running collaboration with Denzel Washington that includes Glory and Courage Under Fire. Of course, he worked with Tom Cruise on The Last Samurai and the second Jack Reacher film, Jack Reacher Never Go Back, worked on Blood Diamond with Leonardo DiCaprio. But then over the course of his book, also talks about coming up through television on the show 30 something and all the lessons that he learned that had led to you know, some of the films that he was producer on, like Shakespeare in Love. I can tell you that the chapter on Shakespeare in Love and how close Ed Zwick got to directing that film with Julia Roberts is worth picking up the book for that alone. The book is actually called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions. It's available everywhere you get your books met. But we had an opportunity because of this book coming out to get Ed to come on the Royal Blend podcast, and we jumped at it. I do want to mention that I had a couple of technical difficulties at the beginning of this episode, and I want to thank Jake for taking the baton and running with it. It was he and I who were going to talk to Ed. Jake ended up handling it fantastically, as you guys are about to see. So without further ado, let's get to our conversation with the director Ed Zwick on behalf of his new book.
You know, whenever I speak with people, anyone in the industry who has lived a career similar to what you have, I always sort of say the same thing, which is like, oh my God, you got to write a book. And I tend to sort of get the same reaction from people, which is, yeah, but I want to keep working, so I can't write the book I would want to write. So I'm sort of curious, when you get to this point in your career and you want to write a book like this, obviously you have to flash back to your past, but to what degree do you have to contemplate and consider your future, at least in regards to what stories you can and or want to tell?
Well, it's a fair question. The difference between me and anybody else asking that question was COVID.
What do you mean?
Well, it hit at a time I was just about to do something. We got literally shut down. And then I got COVID, and I was sitting there for maybe, you know, a month, and forced to sort of look at my life absent that unbelievable focus toward the next thing. And so I began to reflect. And then I didn't admit that I was writing a book for a long period of time. And then all of a sudden it appeared that I did. And I had to acknowledge it. And to tell you the truth, it wasn't at the expense of those things that have been going forward, because what I've learned is you're always riding more than one horse at a time, not knowing which one's going to actually make it to the starting gate. And that's always been true of TV and movies for me. And they move at their pace. And some of them have taken a very long time to get there, and some have taken shorter. But the minute I got into the book, I realized that it was a creative endeavor. It wasn't just a self-glorifying screed. It was actually an attempt to understand certain things about what I do, what movies are, what movies have become. It even had an agenda for me about younger filmmakers who might read it and what it might mean to them. And so I felt that I was going forward with something not very different in its experience than the making of a movie. It's just I wasn't surrounded by, you know, 200 people all the time.
We're going to jump around your career because as two film fans, we could ask nerdy questions about your filmography all day long. But I want to talk about Glory, because if you were to, and people have put together a montage of the great Denzel Washington moments, of which there are hundreds of them, I guarantee you, you can put money down that one of them is going to be the tear rolling down his cheek. I have heard stories as to how that moment happened, but I would love to hear the truth from the horse's mouth and the perspective on those little moments, capturing those little moments like that.
You know, it didn't take a genius to think about how one was going to shoot that moment. There are certain moments in films where you know that you're going to eventually be in a close-up, and it's often a question of how you get there, whether someone is moving into the camera or the camera is moving to them. But this was much more about the circumstances of the moment, because we were in Savannah, Georgia. We were only miles away from where slaves had been enchained in caves during the slave ships and the slave trade. It was a city in which there was still, all sorts of vestigial remnants of the racism of the South, and so there were ghosts, and there was this feeling, as you said, about trying to shoot this scene in which a white man is going to whip a black man, that's going to evoke all sorts of emotion, and not just for the actor, but for the man doing the whipping and for everyone around it who's watching. And so, you know, there's never been a single moment of film that I've shot with Denzel Washington that has not been usable. It's never a question of that. It's never a question of, oh, that's just wrong. It's a question of nuance, or it's a little bit like, you know, if you've ever driven an incredible high performance sports car, and all you do is you touch the wheel a little bit and the car goes screaming around a corner, that's how available and sensitive he is to things and what he can do. So, like the character, he was determined to defy the authority that was and the punishment that was meted out to him. And he was not going to reveal himself and reveal the pain of what was happening in that moment. And we shot it once. We did one take, and it was great. I mean, it's never not great, as I said. But I realized that there was more. And the more had to do with the moment. The more had to do with the moment of this very proud man being subjected to the humiliation of being subjugated and having punishment meted out to him in front of all these people. So there's a meta in that. And how do you deal with that? And one way was to, as often happens in a set, if a director will, you'll change something a little bit so that the first things are happening for the first time. You'll move a prop a little bit so he's got to reach another step to get it. Or you'll do something so it's not routinized. And so I suggested to John Flynn, who was doing the whipping, that he just not stop. And that it wasn't going to be after three whippings that the camera was going to push in, but that maybe it might be four or five or six. And the majesty that is Denzel Washington is not just what he arrives at, but he is combining a real moment where that control is being taken away from him on the stage as an actor, but as it was as a man. And yet all the while, he feels this emotional thing happening, and he also knows that that's what the camera wants, and he's going to be able to stay in that moment of concentration to make that happen. And all of these things are happening at once with the camera moving in to within a foot of his face to get that close up. And the beauty is that it happens, and I'm present enough to know him and to see it happening and to give the right cue to the dolly grip as to when to move in. And that this is one of the beauties of the movie gods, that that camera happens to arrive there at that spot as that thing is happening, as the light manages to hit it in just a way, and it's in focus. Because remember, we're shooting at a time there's not a monitor that's getting that, right? We're just either getting it or it isn't. And I also know that we're not going to do it more than once more. And yet there it was.
I get so much anxiety when I think about the pressure on a focus puller. It's so funny you mentioned that.
Oh.
Antoine Fuqua told me a story when Denzel ad-libbed the King Kong line on the set of Training Day. And he said his first fear was, please tell me that was in focus. Because to your point, you're not getting that again.
No. And what the camera loves most, it's not just when something seems to be happening for the first time, but when it is happening for the time.
That perfectly leads into what is a bit of a follow-up example, but to ask a bigger question, because you talk about capturing those little moments. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, but if you, I've seen a million sort of movie montages of great classic movie moments. And inevitably, a lot of them have the Legends of the Falls, Brad Pitt, hat, little tip, where like the water sort of splashes off the tip of the hat, you know? It's such a great moment, but it's such a tiny moment in the context of what this big, beautiful, epic film. I want to sort of compare, I guess the bigger question is, are there moments that have become iconic in your films where you sort of go, like, look, you look at The Tear in Glory and you go, yeah, of course, that's that moment. But do you ever have moments where as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you go, really? Like, that shot, that's the one?
I think if you, I would respond by saying, if you try to plan those moments, they'll never happen. It will inevitably feel forced. It won't have that breath of life thing that's happening. And that is the beauty, which is that it's a simulacrum of life, but it's not life. And yet what you want is some honest, idiosyncratic present moment to happen. And that's what the camera's going to love. And I think when you look at that montage, of all the other movies, I'm sure that those directors were not necessarily aware that that moment was happening as they filmed it.
That's sort of the line that, you know, anytime you do a junket or you ask about a line or a moment, that seems to be the constant, the common thread, which is like, you never know. And to your point, you can tell when directors, I think, are trying to force it. I want to ask the question that I think Sean was trying to ask before he got cut off. But this book for so many young filmmakers is going to be a blueprint in terms of different directions to go, warning signs and lessons to learn. And I'm sort of curious what you had at the beginning of your career. What was that? Or did you not have anything? Is there a moment where you wish you had had something like this?
Well, the first thing to say is that I do have an agenda. I do feel that there's something that there's a certain set of values in movies that I believe in, that I felt that I was privy to and that I tried to be a proselytizer of, and that maybe some of that will reach younger filmmakers. And yes, there is a cautionary about the bumps and the valleys that you're going to hit and how one deals with them. But the question you're asking about what I was given, I was given extraordinary benefit of being in the presence of real artists at a very tender moment. And the first person that I was able to watch as a 21-year-old was Woody Allen when he was making Love and Death, and then reading the script of Annie Hall. I then went to the American Film Institute, where I was in the presence of a man named Janosch Kadar, a man who had been at the Prague Film School, a teacher of Miloš Forman and Ivan Passer, and a great filmmaker himself, and a woman named Nina Foch, who had been an Academy Award nominated actress, who had been an acting teacher and a disciple of Uta Hagen and Stella Adler. And then, even as I first came into the business, I was introduced and, you know, admitted into this lovely little what is a, this kind of coterie of directors much older than me who were the great lions of the business. It was Paul Mazursky and it was Sidney Pollack and John Frankenheimer and Mark Rydell, these guys who extended themselves. I was on a committee with them when I got admitted to the Academy, and they were available to talk about their experiences. And that was important. But even more important probably were these people who are not obvious. An AD named Skip Cosper, who had been the AD for Deliverance and for Heaven's Gate, or I'm sorry, Days of Heaven. A DP, you know, John Toll, who had been Conrad Hall's operator and Jordan Cronenworth's operator, an extraordinary special effects guy named Paul Lombardi, who's a son of the man who had done the effects for Apocalypse Now.
Oh.
I was literally I could go on and on. Costumers and makeup people and dolly grips and, you know, people who are so full of the knowledge and history of film, and not just that, but the actual execution of film. And I was unafraid to make an ass of myself and ask stupid questions. And I did. And I was determined to learn what they knew so that if I knew their jobs, I would be able to better do mine. And so I very quickly came to understand just what people mean when they talk about this being a collaborative business. Yes, there is somebody saying, go this way. And someone's got to say that. But any number of the people on that group know as much as I do, increasingly now these days, where half of them or maybe three quarters of them have all been to film school. And so that there's a real set of traditions of how you behave, of how something like, you know, what's a protocol? How do things like this happen? How do you solve problems? And it's all there. It's like this moving graduate school, because you don't learn it all in film school. You learn it by making ridiculous, humiliating, mortifying mistakes.
I work in journalism. I always tell people the same thing. You're like, I learned more in my first week in a newsroom than I did 4 years in college. It's not no slight at the college experience, but there's just certain things you can't teach.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I want to ask a question Because one of the things I love most about this book is how honest it is, for better or for worse. And one of the most honest chapters and raw chapters, I think, is your chapter on Shakespeare in Love and particularly what happened Oscar night. Uh-huh. And the question I want to ask isn't necessarily about that night, but when you put it out there, I'd imagine that's not a story that you want to tell every day for the rest of your life. But when you put it out there, it's basically opening up complete strangers to go, well, you wrote about it, so talk to me about it. I'm sort of curious about the chapters that were tougher to tell. I'd imagine that one. In regards to people's permission or this right that they feel to then dive into it and ask you about it as freely as they want to.
Well, I mean, look, for 40 years, I have been writing things that are personal, that are subversive, that are provocative, that are whatever. And I've had them put in the mouths of other people, these very beautiful people, well-lit, well-costumed over there. And there's been a veil that's lifted, that's been there in place, a kind of Chinese firewall that's there, that's protected me. And it was not easy to say, I'm going to go into the first person and I'm going to expose myself in this way. But that made it into a creative, worthwhile experience as an artist to say, can I pursue the truth? Can I try to examine what authenticity really is when I've been so determined to get authenticity from other people? Can I find it from myself? And so I decided, or I just committed myself to be as revealing as I was able. I'm sure there are limits. You know, you talk about the octane of gasoline. Well, what's the percentage of what is the octane of gasoline? You know, it's not 100%, because the truth is, if it was 100%, we would be bored. It would be a book that just was endlessly scrutinizing and not entertaining. So it's a balance that I'm looking for. But I felt that if I was true about the things that are more revealing personally, it would lend credence to those things that were revealing about other people.
I respect that. And as someone, you know, I'm a journalist who believes that not every story needs the other side of the story. And quite frankly, when it comes to Harvey Weinstein and his involvement on Oscar night, I don't really give a shit what his side of the story is. So yours is good enough for me, if you don't mind me saying. I am of the belief that Tom Cruise is one of our great actors. Mm-hmm. I love Last Samurai. I love his performance in Last Samurai. And as much as I appreciate this era that we're in of Mission Impossible and Top Gun, and trust me, I'm there opening weekend. I've done all the junkets. I love it. There is a part of me that misses that 90s, even 2000s Tom Cruise, where I felt like it was less the franchises and the stunts and more like these meaty characters and performances, which you got out of them. I'm just sort of curious, do you feel like we're going to ever go back to that Tom Cruise, or do you ever want to see Cruise again?
I think he has changed it up at different times. You know, he made that movie about the drug runner.
American Made.
I think that, you know, he's clearly an entertainer, and he wants to be there for his audience, and he feels the audience changing. He anticipated that change. Two actors, who one was Tom, the other was Denzel, who suddenly started making The Equalizer. You know, they're smart businessmen too. They have their nose in the wind, and they sense what direction they should be going in. But I also think that he may not be getting those same scripts. There are fewer of those scripts written for someone. And the more persona that you take on, the harder sometimes it is for others or for you to think of the departure from that. And I know the reservoir of ability and feeling that are in him. And we've seen them before. They don't disappear. They don't go away. And in fact, the experiences he's had in his life with his with his marriage, with his children, with things like that. They will only have deepened him as his instrument goes. I would like you hope that we'll see more of that too, because I think we even as he's done this great stuff and, you know, it's helped save the movie business. Mm-hmm. He has more than that to give.
Absolutely. You have directed so many incredible actors to Oscar nominations, and in some cases, actual Oscar wins. But I'm sort of curious, this is going to sound weird, if any of them surprised you in the sense that I remember the morning that Leonardo DiCaprio was nominated for Blood Diamond. Correct me if I'm wrong, that was like the year of The Departed. That was like, yeah. Everyone woke up thinking that the entire cast of The Departed was going to be nominated, including Leonardo DiCaprio. Were you surprised that morning that he got the nomination for Blood Diamond over The Departed?
You know, I try not to think about things in those terms. I know mm-hmm. that sounds silly, but you really don't. If you're thinking about awards, about your own work or somebody else's work, you're thinking about the wrong thing. I loved his work in The Departed. I mean, it was really great. I believe, though, that the challenge, that the bar might have been higher to do the part that he does in Blood Diamond than it was in The Departed. So I think, you know, if you were judges for, you know, at an Olympic event, and you were having a degree of difficulty about a particular dive, I think it was a high degree of difficulty. And that might have been the difference. I don't know.
That's interesting. You know, it is pretty interesting to think about how many amazing actors you worked with near the beginning of their career. And if there's one thing I don't mean to keep comparing your industry to journalism because it's apples and oranges. But one thing I do tell interns whenever they come through is to just be nice to everybody, because you never know that person who you're talking down to could end up being your news director one day. So I'm sort of curious about this idea of your work with young actors and, you know, never knowing who's going to sort of blow up, and what advice you would give to actor or to directors, to filmmakers working with unknown actors, especially because, as you've seen in your case, you never know who's going to be the next Matt Damon or the next Denzel or whatever the case may be.
Well, you know, the first thing as a director you come to understand is that there's no movie, a movie is no better than the smallest part in it. Literally, that one bad supporting actor, one bad day player can ruin a scene can ruin a movie. And so the attention that you pay in casting those people is as great as the attention you pay in choosing the movie stars. So that you will have already spent time reading actors, even for a one or two line part, because you want them to have all of the qualities that everybody else has in the movie. And I guess what that means is that you will have submitted the acid test to every actor who's coming before you in the movie. In other words, you won't have treated them any differently than you've treated your movie stars. You will have really endowed them with a sense of character and a sense of behavior and really an attention, because that's where the movie stars were when they began. You know, a movie star is that day player who's just starting, just it happens to be, you know, several million dollars later, but it is that thing. So when, you know, when Matt Damon walks into my room to cast, or, you know, when Claire Danes was 13 years old, or Evan Rachel Wood, or any number of people like that, you sense it. And you sense it also in young actors. I think I tell the story in the book about Brad Pitt doing a one day part on 30 something. And he walks on stage and all of a sudden people are kind of going, who's that? What is that? And how do you describe that thing? How do you describe that movie star essence, that charismatic thing that radiates, the things that come from inside? And yes, it's the play of shadow and light on a face. And yes, it's what the skin is like and the eyes, but it's more than that. And you know it when you see it. And a lot of times you know it in just a day player. You may not ever be able to get more from that because they're only supposed to be in the scene for, you know, a couple of minutes, but it's there.
On the flip side of that, you also have worked with legendary actors at the height of their careers. I think of, you know, you worked with Bruce and Annette Bening and you worked with Sir Anthony Hopkins. You mentioned trepidation. Has there ever been a moment where you've been weary of giving notes in that regard? Or is it just a, like, listen, I got a job to do, you got a job to do, and we got to meet in the middle?
That's a fair question. I mean, everybody's different. You know, a lot of actors absolutely want to be treated, a lot of movie stars want to be treated as actors. They know that there's something you can give them, and they're interested in hearing about it, and they let you know that very, very easily, very quickly. There are others you learn the other lesson. you presume to try to tell an actor something, and you'll get this kind of, like they don't want to engage. They want to do their work, and the work that you've hired them to do, you know, is going to be great. The problem is maybe if you get someone like that who thinks that they know what they're doing and that they're great at it when they're not getting the thing that you want to have happen. And I can think that's only happened to me once or twice with sort of really experienced actors. And it's awkward. Mm-hmm. It's really awkward because you're not doing it publicly, but even so, there's an issue of pride and ego that you come up against, and you don't want to have them shut down to you with this notion that maybe you're in some sense denigrating what they do, but to try to communicate that what you want is slightly different.
I'm going to cut you loose by sort of circling back to the beginning, if you don't mind, because I'd love to talk really quickly about your work in television, because sure. You mentioned 30-something. You know, you think about all the great stars that we got. You mentioned Brad, but you think of, you know, like Tom Hanks came from TV and Leonardo DiCaprio got his start in television. And these days, it's no surprise whenever, you know, you look at TV credits and see, you know, an Oscar-winning director, you know, taking on an episode. But I feel like when you were doing it, TV, please correct me if I'm wrong, but TV was almost looked at as like a lesser art form. Times, I feel like, have changed, obviously. We're in a completely different era. I'm just sort of curious at how you feel about the direction TV has gone in and the importance that you had working at TV early in your career.
Well, there are two separate questions. The second one first. The first movie I made was called About Last Night, which was about young people and love and sex. And it was, you know, fun and comic and people in rooms talking. And the second movie I made was Glory. I could not have made the second movie had I not done 30-something in between and shot 40 hours of film where we were writing it and shooting it and cutting it and scoring it. And it was like a musician coming to get better in the fingering of a stringed instrument or the armature of a horn. That it was about learning chops, and I would analogize it to looking at IMDb in any director's career that you really admire, particularly in the olden days. George Stevens, John Ford, Howard Hawks, all these guys, they did 20 or 30 two-reelers. They did Harold Lloyd comedies. They did Buster Keaton movies. They did The Three Stooges. I mean, they were the Marx Brothers. They shot film, and they learned with every foot of film that they shot. And for me, and this is one of the ways that Sidney Pollack and I really found common ground. He began in television. He was he shot Gunsmoke, and he shot, I don't know, Naked City. I'm making these up. He shot a lot of, you know, 60s sure. television. And the same thing was true for Frank Pearson. And the same thing was true for Mark Rydell. And the same thing was true for Sidney Lumet. You know, these guys were guys who had to solve problems and do it quickly and learn you know, the craft at a smaller scale so that then when they have the opportunity to raise it to a bigger scale. One problem, I think, is sometimes a kid makes an independent movie at Sundance and he's shot 2 hours of film. And then he gets a job to make a movie with many, many millions of dollars and big stars. And it's a very difficult transition sometime. Now, people have done it great, you know, but others haven't.
That's I could talk with you all day. Ed, seriously, the book is phenomenal. I cannot stress enough how much our audience is your audience for the book. I know you have an insanely busy day. I could talk to you all day. I'm sorry you got stuck with me tonight. Sean ended up having tech issues.
Please apologize to your partner for I'll meet him another time. Listen, it means a lot because there's not a lot of money in marketing books these days. And the way that we're trying to sell a book is exactly like this. So everything you do on his behalf, I really appreciate. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, we got your back 100%. And thank you for telling stories with me for half hour, man. I really do appreciate it. It's a real honor.
All right.
Take care. Bye, guys.
Thank you so much to Ed Zwick for coming on the Real Blend podcast. Again, just go over his filmography, guys. I mean, he's had a number of incredible films. Glory being one that we talk about all the time. Blood Diamond, another one with Leonardo DiCaprio. The chapters that he writes about collaborating with Tom Cruise are inspirational. This is one of those really great behind the scenes deep dives into a filmmaker whose movies you've grown up on, essentially. And he gets very candid in terms of the struggles that he had of putting them together, how he would go from these high highs to some crushing lows, which just come with the industry. So make sure you pick up this book. Again, it's called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions by director Ed Zwick. And boy, are we happy to have him on the show. Keep it here on the Real Blend channel. Make sure you hit subscribe and turn on your notifications. We have new episodes dropping every Friday morning that have interviews very similar to this, as well as our commentary on the ongoing activities in the movie industry. I'm Sean O'Connell. I'm joined, as always, by Jake Hamilton and Kevin McCarthy. They'll be back on the main show with me coming up soon. So we will talk to you guys down the road.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.